Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars, artists, and librarians about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm talking today with Brian Van Norden, professor of philosophy at Vassar on the James Monroe Taylor Chair. He also holds an appointment in the School of Philosophy at Wuhan University in Wuhan, China, and recently returned to Vassar from 3 years as a visiting professor at the Yale NUS College in Singapore. Brian is talking with us by telephone today about his book, Taking Back Philosophy, a Multicultural Manifesto, published by Columbia University Press in 2017. Hello, Brian.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show. As you mentioned, I'm here via telephone, and I also have my French bulldog, Diego, who's decided to sit in my lap, so we may hear him sighing or barking in the background at some point.
Yeah, I've seen photographs of Diego on Facebook. It looks like he has a lot of character. So if he wants to be part of the conversation, that's great. I just wanted to start out by asking you about your posts in China and Singapore, especially because your book is about transcending national intellectual boundaries, and you've been teaching overseas and transcending boundaries yourself, I suppose. So can you tell us about your teaching overseas, both in China, in Wuhan, which must have been an interesting place these last few years, and also in Singapore more recently?
Well, yeah, I've had the honor of teaching, as you point out, in both China at Wuhan University, which is one of the top universities in China, and also at Yale NUS College, which is a liberal arts college modeled on the American model of liberal arts colleges like Vassar. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting to think about the fact that a lot of countries around the world, particularly in Asia, are starting to develop liberal arts colleges because they recognize that there's something very valuable about the kind of education in which physicists or people who are going to become physicists have to read poetry, and people who are going to become novelists have to learn a little bit about chemistry and biology. So the liberal arts college model, which is sometimes under attack in the United States, people in other parts of the world recognize that it's one of the keys to American academic success. So that's why Singapore is founding a liberal arts college like Yale NUS, and I was there for 3 years helping out developing their multicultural curriculum. Mm-hmm. They've got a two-semester philosophy sequence called Philosophy and Political Thought that's required of all first-year students. And it's a multicultural introduction to philosophy in which students read Confucius, but also Plato. They read Laozi or the Zhuangzi, one of the foundational figures of Taoism, but also Aristotle. And they read the Bhagavad Gita from the Indian tradition, as well as Gandhi, all in this two-semester multicultural philosophy sequence. Uh-huh. And I've now developed a version of this course which I'm teaching this semester at Vassar.
Interesting, because they were a little ahead of their time way back in the 1970s. Seminars that I took that were, I think the titles were Great Books of the East, where we were studying literature from Asia and the Middle East. And one of these things that my professors were telling us was that this isn't unusual in the East to have, say, statesmen having to have a poetic background to be a statesman. I mean, I think Tu Fu is the example, but it was common in China in one time, wasn't it, for someone who wanted to go into politics to have to be able to write poetry and read poetry. Am I right there?
That's exactly right. The civil service examinations in China, which the traditional version ended with the last Chinese dynasty, the Qing, which ended in the early 20th century. But for centuries, Chinese students were expected to study and even memorize classics of philosophy, history, and poetry as preparation for careers in government. And in fairness, you know, if you consider the long run over millennia in China, they had some very successful statesmen. They might know something about how you actually should educate students.
Interesting. The West isn't completely devoid of that. I mean, it was the model in the Renaissance also for political people to have a wide-ranging literary education.
Yeah, and we know from Vassar College and other liberal arts colleges, students go on from these very diverse backgrounds where they take courses in literature, but also in the hard sciences and social sciences like economics. And given this very diverse background, they go on to a variety of careers, military, law, medicine, and government and diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And they find that these broad educational backgrounds extremely useful for dealing with the increasingly multicultural and complex world that people have to face today.
Yeah, we're conflicted, however, anymore with so many students transferring into STEM and liberal arts departments losing majors, worrying about what's going to become of the whole liberal arts idea. But China in particular seems to have realized that this is a very good thing, yes? So
exactly, and now there's a liberal arts college established at Peking University, often considered the top university in China. And like I say, in Singapore, they've developed a liberal arts college. There are liberal arts college experiments in India, in Japan. So while we in the U.S. are becoming more skeptical of what's been one of our greatest educational achievements, ironically, the rest of the world is realizing, no, Americans, you know, are onto something. There's a reason that the United States has been a technological economic leader, and a lot of it has to do with the high quality and diversity of the education we give our students.
Yeah, I'm sure you have a lot of things lined up and things to dream about, but actually we could all use a monograph on explaining exactly what's going on in China in particular in terms of education and the Middle East also, and this model being transported from particularly American institutions, but I think the British and the European Union are involved too to some extent, importing these models into places where they weren't before. And it's extremely interesting cultural phenomenon that's kind of overlooked a bit in the mainstream media.
I think it is. And as you know, in some parts of my book, Taking Back Philosophy, I talk about the continuing relevance of Confucian ideas in China. In the 20th century, some Chinese intellectuals became convinced that traditional systems of thought like Confucianism, Taoism, and Buddhism were outmoded, and that China could only become a powerful modern state by leaving those things behind and learning Western natural science, Western technology, and just abandoning what they considered as superstitious systems of thought. Mm. But there were always a handful of people who thought that Confucianism, like Christianity or Hinduism or Judaism or many other systems of thought, can continue to be relevant in the modern world. And in a real surprise, President Xi Jinping of China has come out and endorsed Confucianism. Mm. And so after years in the Cultural Revolution period in China under Mao from 66 to 76, where Confucianism was blamed for China's backwardness in earlier periods, and Confucius was labeled a reactionary, old-fashioned, feudalistic thinker, we now have a powerful Chinese leader saying, no, we Chinese should be reading Confucius, and we should be learning from Confucians. Mm-hmm. And if you want to be well-informed about what's going on in the world today and geopolitics, you need to learn about the systems of thought that are especially influential in other cultures, like Confucianism in China, or Buddhism is increasingly influential in China, as well as in, you know, many other parts of the world. And so these are things that we have to learn about if we want to be a well-informed contemporary citizen.
Certainly for understanding the rest of the world, I can see it's important, but just for understanding ourselves also. And of course, if you do look at what has seeped into the popular literature and contemporary culture, popular culture, Buddhism and Taoism for certain have taken hold. I mean, that's why we were all studying in the 1970s these texts from the East, because there was some feeling that we weren't being satisfied, especially by Western religion, and Western philosophy was almost among undergraduates something of not any great interest unless they were really into philosophy. That's got to still be there driving this. Yes, to some extent, people must be very interested in their spiritual well-being.
Yep. I mean, I always tell students, you know, one thing you want to remember is you don't want to bore yourself in the rest of your life. Right. So you're going to live a long time. You want to fill your mind with interesting things so that you're not just a narrow two-dimensional person who doesn't have anything interesting to think about. So that's one reason for studying philosophy. Another reason for studying philosophy is philosophical issues come up a lot more than you would think. So issues about, for example, should we teach intelligent design or creationism in public schools in addition to evolutionary theory? This depends on understanding what it is that distinguishes natural science from other kinds of activities. And in order to understand that, philosophy of science is one of the things that helps you to understand that. Or we have a lot of issues now about freedom of expression and cancel culture and like what is the true nature of freedom of expression. John Stuart Mill's book on liberty has had a huge influence in conditioning what people, including people in positions in government and law, really think about freedom of expression. And so it's worth understanding what Mill said on this topic, but it's also important to understand critiques of Mill's view, like, for example, those given by the great German-American philosopher Herbert Marcuse. Mm-hmm. And I've written an op-ed about this that came out in the New York Times a couple of years ago. So philosophy really matters to a lot of important contemporary issues, and that's another reason why it's worth studying.
Philosophy per se, yes. I was a philosophy major and continued my studies ever since, a PhD in medieval literature. But everything I read in literature, I always back off and read heavily in the philosophical tradition it comes out of. I mean, it seemed to be a necessity. And it's always informed then anything I've ever had to say about literary works, and it informs my teaching in a classroom too. I mean, I'm teaching Edna St. Vincent Millay right now. And if you read Heidegger's Origin of the Work of Art, you can see in it Millay's vision in her poem Renaissance of this kind of world coming into being for the first time before her eyes, and a critique of Descartes in a sense also. So anyway, yeah, philosophy is a great thing. I agree. So
exactly. And if I'm not mistaken, didn't Edna St. Vincent Millay say Euclid alone has looked on beauty bare?
Yes, yeah, she did. Yeah.
And that's a great line, and it's impossible to understand what she means by that unless you know the Platonic background against which that claim makes sense.
Yes,
it would be very hard to make that claim, for example, in the Chinese intellectual tradition. People wouldn't know what you're talking about. But in the Anglo-European intellectual tradition, there's this, as you know, this tradition going back to Plato, that mathematics is the key to understanding the ultimate nature of the universe, and that there's a kind of beauty in mathematical truth that teaches us something about the true nature of beauty in itself.
Yeah.
So you can't even understand a work of literature like that without understanding some philosophy.
So Vassar taught Vincent very well there, gave a nice background. Philosophy was required, of course.
I think it's not technically required anymore, but most students do end up at some point taking a philosophy course at Vassar because we have such a diverse and really outstanding philosophy department, especially for a liberal arts college, a number of outstanding figures in our department. Professor Uma Narayan is one of the leading experts on development ethics and third world feminism. You know, I can't mention everybody, but Professor Barry Lamb has the famous philosophy podcast called Hi-Fi Nation, and it's a really great department, and a lot of students have had great experiences with it.
There's a wider audience that we need to cultivate here. I mean, apart from the student audience, and you seem to be doing that in the book here. The book is a manifesto about the teaching of philosophy, educational perhaps manifesto, but it would be of interest to philosophers also. But it seemed to me it is aimed at a wider audience than your usual academic monograph in the field. So I guess my question is there an implied statement in this expansion beyond the traditional academy to a wider community of readers in your book? Because your book would be of keen interest to people just picking it up off the bookshelf who weren't students particularly, who want to know what's going on in the contemporary world.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. Taking Back Philosophy is intended for a wider audience. And as I think you know, as I explained in the book was really inspired by a notorious New York Times op-ed that Jay Gornfield wrote called If Philosophy Won't Diversify, Let's Call It What It Really Is. And it was a featured op-ed, and the original idea came from Jay Garfield, who teaches at Smith College, and he'd been saying for years that philosophy departments that don't teach anything outside of the Anglo-European canon should change their names to departments of Western philosophy or departments of Anglo-European philosophy to make clear that they were intentionally deciding not to teach any of the great philosophy from the South Asian, East Asian, Africana, or indigenous American traditions. And he said it to me, I said, that's a great idea. Let's write an op-ed about that. So we wrote this op-ed calling on philosophy departments to either expand the canon of works that they teach or at least be honest and rename yourself to reflect how parochial you are. And it got a very passionate response with some people very enthusiastically positive about it, but also a number of people very, very negative. And so Columbia University Press invited us to write a book about it. Jay was too busy, but he wrote a terrific foreword, and I wrote the book, and I wrote it in a chatty kind of style, an accessible style with, you know, some jokes and lots of common everyday life examples to illustrate it. You can read it as it's written. Some colleagues have used it to teach at other institutions, and some of them recommend reading the book backwards. Because if you start with the last chapter, which is about why I find philosophy personally exciting and what infuriates me but also excites me about a lot of philosophical works, you can start there, and then that's chapter 5. And then in chapter 4, I talk about the great historical influence of philosophy and how natural science grew out of philosophy and the influence that philosophy has had on things like the development of democratic institutions as well as natural science, and how people like Einstein and Schrodinger of Schrodinger's cat fame both said that it was really useful for physicists to study philosophy. And then in the third chapter, I talk about the political relevance of philosophy and how philosophy has become kind of a lightning rod in the culture wars in the United States, but also how it's become controversial in China and this issue of whether or not Confucianism is going to be part of China's long-term identity. Then in chapter 2, I give a bunch of examples of how Western and Chinese philosophy can be brought into dialogue. But then in chapter 1, I just point out how few Western philosophy departments actually teach any of Chinese or any kind of East Asian or South Asian, Indian philosophy or Africana philosophy, indigenous American philosophy. And the Vassar philosophy department is distinctive and unusual in being really open-minded and regularly offering courses in Chinese philosophy and comparative philosophy and having someone like me who teaches these topics regularly.
Other departments like art history have been teaching Asian art and world art for quite a long time now. And I can see why there might be an argument if you're teaching students about Chinese painting or Japanese landscape painting, why you would want them to be able to also go into the philosophy department and study Chinese or Japanese philosophy. You know, makes perfect sense. Otherwise, you couldn't study in a multidisciplinary way what we're studying in other departments.
Exactly. And Jay Garfield points out in his foreword to the book that philosophy is really backward in terms of humanities disciplines as a whole, in that most other disciplines have at least started, as you say, expanding the curriculum. And so in art, you're going to be studying non-Western art. In literature departments, they're expanding to be comparative literature departments and teaching other literary traditions. And philosophy among humanities disciplines has been one of the more conservative in terms of embracing things from outside the Anglo-European tradition.
Very interesting. So I'm not sure if when you entitle a book Taking Back Philosophy, you're talking about taking back philosophy from philosophy departments. But it is a world of hard surfaces, the discipline of philosophy. And I wonder about that. I mean, there's this reticence for people studying in that discipline to move beyond accustomed authorities. Is it because it's such an authority-bound discipline, possibly, or, as theology would be? Or
well, I think it's not that. I mean, I talk about this a little bit in the book. There's a couple things that are going on. On the one hand, I say it's taking back philosophy for a couple of reasons. on the one hand, when Westerners first learned about East Asian philosophy and South Asian philosophy, like especially Chinese and Indian philosophy, they immediately recognized the text they were reading as philosophical. So the first translation of the sayings of Confucius into a Western language was done by Jesuits who had extensive exposure to Western philosophy as part of their training, and they translated the Analects, the sayings of Confucius, into Latin as Confucius Sinarum Philosophus, Confucius the Chinese philosopher, because they immediately recognized what he was doing as philosophical. And it wasn't only until later, as pseudoscientific notions of race developed in the 19th and late 18th centuries, that people got it into their heads that, in the words of Immanuel Kant, no one who wasn't white was capable of doing philosophy. Kant actually said this in his lectures, and the students of Kant rewrote the philosophy textbooks and wrote South Asian, Indian, and Chinese and other kinds of East Asian philosophy out of the philosophy curriculum when they'd been in the curriculum before. And Peter K.J. Park has a great book about this, about Africa, Asia, and the philosophical canon, in which he documents how this process occurred in detail. And the second way in which I see my book, so we want to take back philosophy in the sense of, like, let's go back to when we all recognized that there were philosophical traditions outside the one that goes back to Plato and Aristotle. And the other kind of taking back is philosophy in every culture is really grounded in questions that are important to everyday human beings, like, what's the purpose of life? You know, what's the basis of government authority? How can I know what is true about the world? These are questions that any reflective person should be interested in. And occasionally philosophy nowadays has a tendency, I don't think we have this problem too much at Vassar, but at other institutions, where philosophy just becomes an intellectual game where you play certain intellectual games and then you try to win at those games, but they've lost touch with the exciting issues that really motivated people to study philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's worth remembering that Martin Luther King Jr. studied philosophy and in fact taught philosophy, and he said that his favorite book after the Bible, he was after all a Protestant minister, but Martin Luther King Jr. said his favorite book after the Bible was Plato's Republic, because it's about escaping bondage to illusions and coming to see the world as it actually is. So those are some of the things that are going on in philosophy. Now, in fairness, I think part of the insularity and the resistance that we see on the part of philosophical colleagues at other institutions has to do with the fact that philosophy has a very special role it plays in contemporary humanity, which is that philosophy is one of the last disciplines that consistently takes truth and the search for truth seriously. I was at a multidisciplinary conference just a couple of years ago back in Singapore, and one of my philosophy colleagues was talking about the value of studying Chinese philosophy. And one of the points he made was, he said, well, Chinese thinkers might know some truths that people in my tradition, the tradition I was raised in, don't know. And I'd like to know those truths. And some colleagues from other institutions and other intellectual disciplines were saying, well, what does he mean truth? I mean, who's concerned with truth? Why would anybody be concerned with what the truth is? And I said to them, look, I would think in the current political environment, we'd all now understand the importance of actual truth and finding the truth and trying to be honest and trying not to lie and trying not to argue sophistically and trying to argue in a genuinely sincere way in order to get the truth, I think we'd appreciate now more than ever why these things are important. But it just turns out that in many cases, philosophy departments are the only ones that are taking the notions of rationality and truth seriously. So I think that's why when philosophers are confronted by colleagues saying, hey, why aren't you reading these other texts? Why do you guys think you know all the truths? Or why do you think that there is a truth that you're getting to? They're kind of resistant to these cults. So I understand to some extent where some of my philosophy colleagues at other institutions are coming from.
You could use that as a starting point and say, if you're asking the question, what does he mean by truth? I mean, we have the beginning of wisdom, you know, so they're asking a philosophical
right.
question.
Very true, that's right.
So what kinds of arguments do people level against you, especially from the philosophical world, against your wanting to include these other authorities and classic texts in the curriculum? When you published your article in the Times, I know the comments were off the charts. I mean, the numbers of comments you got in. Certainly in that series that the Times was doing at the time, was it called A Stone? They'd never seen
yes.
anything like it. So what kinds
yeah.
of arguments do you have leveled against you?
Some arguments are just transparently bad.
Yeah.
So one argument people gave was they say, oh, come on, Western civilization's clearly superior. Would you want to fly in a plane built with non-Western mathematics? You know, but in case people in our audience don't know, one of the first things that occurs to me is, you know, well, there's this new thing going around called Arabic numerals. Perhaps you've heard of them. They're kind of catching on right now. And, you know, the use of zero, the numeral zero, which revolutionized mathematics, of course, originally came from India. And from India, it went through the Arab world to be adopted in European mathematics. And Chinese thinkers independently discovered what we call the Pythagorean theorem. It was independently discovered and proven with a very elegant proof millennia ago in China. So that's just kind of a trivially bad argument. But a little bit better arguments. I mean, some people will say, for example, well, but philosophy isn't just about a topic. It's about a genre and a methodology. And so it only counts as philosophy if it's written in a certain style and if it uses arguments.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, if you actually bother to look at, for example, the traditions I know the best, Chinese philosophy and Indian philosophy, there's plenty of arguments in these texts. There's reductio ad absurdum arguments. There's thought experiments. There's the use of counterexamples, generalization and counterexamples. So there are plenty of arguments in non-Western philosophical texts. In addition, in terms of genre, Western philosophy has been written in a lot of genres. I mean, you mentioned poetry earlier. One of the first things you typically read in a course on ancient Western philosophy is the writings of Parmenides. Parmenides wrote a long poem on the nature of being, and this is one of the seminal works of the Western philosophical tradition. Plato wrote in dialogue. Other philosophers write in essay form or in expository book form. Some philosophers write in aphorisms like Pascal or Wittgenstein in the Tractatus. And you find all of these genres, dialogue, essay, of course also aphorism and poetry, but you certainly find essays in philosophy outside the mainstream Anglo-European canon. You find books. You find all the genres and all the styles of argumentation that you find in Western philosophy, you also find in, for example, Indian and Chinese philosophy. It sounds like a better argument to look at the genre and the methods, but when you do look at the genre and methods, you find, no, there actually is philosophy outside the European canon. Another thing that sounds like a good argument at first, but when you think about it, you realize it's not, is people will say, well, look, whom would you drop from the canon? Who would you take out of the canon in the West to add some thinkers from other traditions? And the fact is, no philosophy department, not even the biggest philosophy departments at the biggest universities in the West, are comprehensive in their coverage of Western philosophy.
Mm.
So the canon has always been disputed. Cicero used to be central to the Western philosophical canon. And Hume used to be peripheral, if it even was a part of the Western philosophical canon. Nowadays, it's unusual for people to ever read Cicero, and Hume is front and center. So thinkers have always come in and gone out. So you're never going to have comprehensive coverage of any one tradition. The only question is, are you going to acknowledge that we live in the United States, a multicultural country with increasingly large populations who do not identify as white of European descent, and we live in a world in which the cultures of India and Pakistan and China and Japan and African nations are extremely influential, and we have to understand them if we want to know how to navigate this complicated multicultural world.
Is it a personnel problem also? I mean, philosophy departments tend to be small compared to other departments at most institutions. And I mean, there's a lot to cover. So is some of the opposition just institutional, bureaucratic? You know, you don't have a slot for this person. And, you know, if I say I have to cut something, that means if, when we hire somebody, do we really have to cut a big chunk out of what we do?
So people have to make hard decisions. But what I'd often say to people is when you're hiring, ask yourself, do you need another expert on Kant?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you just need another expert on the tradition that goes back to Plato and Aristotle? Or do you need at least one person who's talking about all the many traditions other than that tradition in philosophy? So I got a good education at Stanford University. That's where I got my PhD in philosophy. And at that time, there was someone teaching Chinese philosophy, although there's no one, sadly, teaching Chinese philosophy in the philosophy department at Stanford now. But I did tease my colleagues there and say, look, we've got four people on the faculty who teach different aspects of the philosophy of language. And we've got one person who covers the entire Chinese philosophical tradition. And we literally did. We had four people who covered different aspects of philosophy of language at Stanford when I was a graduate student there, and one person who covered the entire Chinese philosophical tradition. Does that make sense? And so when you're hiring, ask, do you really need another person in the same tradition, or do you need somebody to represent one of the many other traditions that are increasingly influential in the world and that might be traditions that people, students, identify with more or less clearly?
So that begins to answer my next question. What do philosophy departments and extending out the academy itself have to gain by not maintaining the status quo? And one of those things might be that students who might not be interested in taking a philosophy class might be more interested if it did speak to the reality that they live every day and who they are, right?
Exactly. Philosophy as an intellectual discipline has a diversity problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so to a greater extent than other fields, on average, philosophy departments attract more male students than they do female students. They attract more white students than they do students of color. And this is an ongoing problem in the discipline. And I think part of the problem may be that oftentimes philosophy departments come across as essentially temples to the achievements of white males. And just acknowledging that there are other intellectual traditions besides the one that's become canonical in the West is an important step in diversifying philosophy and, in the long run, ensuring the survival of philosophy as an academic discipline. You know, we can't continue as an academic discipline if we're not attracting the diversity of students who increasingly make up the population of college and university students in the United States.
So if drawing other traditions into philosophy can help philosophy departments and help the academy itself, can the culture itself be helped here by philosophy departments doing this? I mean, is there something that by expanding out philosophy departments could do to make what goes on in the liberal arts and what goes on in colleges and universities more interesting and more valuable to what's happening in the culture per se, to break the walls between the academy and the world?
Yeah, I think, and again, this is one of the themes of my book, I think philosophy needs to return to its roots, which are really about addressing issues that everybody who's at all intellectually alive can see the relevance of. Let me tell you an anecdote to illustrate what I think is the problem, but also I think the direction for improvement. I was at a talk when I was visiting at Yale NUS, and a visiting scholar had come in, a very good philosopher had come in from Australia, and he was talking about this very subtle argument about what mental states are, right? So there's been a big problem in philosophy has wrestled with for millennia, which is when we have a thought or an idea or a feeling or some kind of mental state, how is that mental state related to our physical state? In other words, how is your neurology, your brain and your nervous system and your physical senses, how are they related to things like your thoughts, your feelings, your ideas, your experiences as a particular subjective individual? And he gave a really interesting, albeit very technical, talk on this topic. And at the end, I said, well, this is fascinating, and I learned a lot, but I'm just wondering, what do you think the payoff is here? So for people like Descartes, when Descartes talked about the relationship between mind and body, he thought it was important to understand that these are different things, mind and body, so you'll know that your soul is immortal. Mm-hmm. And so you'll know that there's more to life than just your physical existence here on Earth. Now you, I said to the speaker, I said, you're telling us that there don't seem to be mental states that are different from physical states. So is this because you want to convince people that there's nothing to life except the physical world? Or do you see yourself opposing superstition or obscurantism in the form of belief in things that aren't real? What's the payoff here in terms of this? And he kind of shrugged and said, well, basically, I'm just saying the most plausible satisfiers for the phrase mental state don't happen to exist. That was it. It's just the best satisfiers of the phrase mental state happen not to exist. Didn't think there was any bigger payoff than that. So this is what I mean by sometimes philosophy just becomes a game where the game is, here's a phrase, mental state, and I'm going to look for the satisfier. It was a technical term in law, the satisfier for that phrase. And then I'm going to give you this a really complicated argument for why the best satisfier of that ordinary language expression doesn't exist, but it doesn't imply anything else about life, the universe, and everything. That's the kind of thing that I completely understand why students might be like, oh, I don't know why I need to study this. I don't know why you need to study that either. But if we're asking things like, hey, you know, Confucians say that you have an ethical obligation to your parents because they're your parents and because of the benefits you receive from them being raised by them, that you do not have to other people. Whereas a classic utilitarian or a Moist, which was an ancient school critical of the Confucians, would say the only obligations you have are obligations that you have to all humans in general, not obligations to particular individuals that you're tied to by certain bonds. That's an issue we should all think about. I mean, do I have an obligation to my parents because they're my parents? Or do I only have an obligation to my parents insofar as they're human beings and I owe an obligation to them just like I have to every human being? That's a very living question for any human being.
Yeah, there's a lot here. You have a chapter called Traditions and Dialogue where you talk about Buddhist, Taoist, Confucian, and Neo-Confucian philosophy and show how they might inform traditional questions in philosophy and enrich those questions and the answer that we have developed over time addressing those questions. And I wonder, can you talk just a bit about that? Maybe give an example. You have wonderful examples from ethics and political philosophy.
So one issue would be most of us think that we have a self that is distinct from the selves of other people. So we think, I'm one self, I'm one person, you are a separate person. But interestingly, Buddhist philosophers give some very challenging arguments for why there isn't a self. They admit it's useful to talk as if there's a self, but they say there isn't a thing, a soul, or any kind of entity which is identifiable with the self. And why does that make any difference? Well, if you could convince us that we don't have a self, then most of the things we do in life that we do out of self-interest are ultimately confused. Because on a Buddhist conception, trying to benefit yourself or trying to possess something for yourself is a double mistake. It's a mistake because you don't have a self that could possess anything. In addition, the things in the world that you're trying to possess don't have a self either. So you're an illusory thing trying to possess another illusory thing. So most of what motivates us most of the time, which is self-interest, is based on a confusion. Now, on the other hand, if we have selves, and this is something that René Descartes argued, he says there has to be a self that is the bearer of our mental states and is the thing that has volition and that has desire and that has thoughts. There has to be that soul self. That has ethical implications because it justifies a certain kind of self-interest. It also justifies a political philosophy which assumes that humans are fundamentally independent and that justifies society as a way for fundamentally independent humans to achieve their individual self-interest through cooperation with others. But cooperation with others, if we've got a self, is only justified insofar as it benefits you. But if there isn't a self, or if the self is somehow dependent for its identity on other people, then there isn't really a fundamental conflict between my individual well-being and the well-being of my society, because my identity is tied into the identity of society as a whole. Let me try to make that a little bit more concrete. At the beginning of the COVID crisis, one thing I talked about with my students in Singapore, I showed them some videos of U.S. college students partying over spring break, and they were being interviewed about, well, why are you doing this given that there's a COVID epidemic and they're saying that you should avoid large crowds and here you are in Florida for spring break and you're hanging out with other people. Meanwhile, at that time in Singapore, people were being very careful about obeying government regulations, about wearing masks in public, avoiding large gatherings, keeping restaurants and other occasions for people to gather in public closed so that people could be isolated and avoid infecting one another. So in Singapore, which has been influenced by communal ideas about what the self is, people were very happy to cooperate and work together for the common good. But in the U.S., which is deeply influenced by strongly individualistic ideas, it's been much harder to get people, in many cases, to cooperate with rules about working together for the common good or wearing a mask so that you can protect other people in public. And people think they know better than experts on these topics. And this is tied to whether or not you think the individual is radically separate from your community, or do you think that the individual's identity depends on the identity of the community? I do talk about this in chapter 2 of Taking Back Philosophy. I also contributed a chapter to another book, How to Live a Good Life, which was edited by Massimo Liucci, Sky Cleary, and Daniel Kaufman. And that's got chapters on, I wrote a chapter on Confucianism for that. But there's also chapters on Taoism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Stoicism, Existentialism, and other movements. And each of them talks about what the views are about the nature of the self in these traditions and what ethical implications follow from the understanding they have of the self and its relationship to the universe. And so you get these very interesting issues that connect issues in personal identity, but also issues in ethics. And in those work, we deal in more detail about what the arguments are for these various positions.
Really interesting, absolutely fascinating, especially because of the way it does relate to what's going on around us everywhere. You are a South and East Asian philosophy specialist, but your book is a call for multiculturalism generally in philosophy. And there are traditions like African, Native American, pre-Columbians that you don't address specifically because you don't have any background there. But you do have a bibliography, don't you, as a sort of gateway into these other traditions?
Exactly. I've got a website, BryanVanNorden.com, so BryanVanNorden.com. And on that website, I have a bibliography of suggested readings on what I refer to as the less commonly taught philosophy. And I borrowed that expression from language instruction. People who teach foreign languages refer to the less commonly taught languages. And it's a nice label for referring to the group of languages that includes Japanese, Swahili, Arabic. And these languages are very different. They're not part of the same language group, but they have in common the fact that they are not commonly taught in high school or even in colleges and universities in the United States. So I said, okay, well, here's a nice label for the philosophies, which are very different in themselves and from different traditions, that are not commonly taught in Western philosophy departments. And so on my website, I've got a bibliography And I'm not an expert in Africana philosophy, which includes both the philosophy of people in Africa or born in Africa, like Kwasi Waredu or Kwame Anthony Appiah. But Africana philosophy also includes the philosophy of the so-called African diaspora. So people of African descent who were born in and lived in other parts of the world, like Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, Cornel West, a leading contemporary African-American philosopher. There's indigenous American philosophy, which, as you point out, includes both the philosophy of contemporary indigenous American people or Native Americans, like Anne Waters, who was the first Native American to get a PhD in philosophy, and Kyle White, who's a contemporary environmental philosopher and also a Native American, but also pre-Columbian philosophy, like the philosophy of the Maya and Aztec people. And then, of course, there's the philosophy of India and other parts of South Asia and China and other parts of East Asia. And I know enough about the other traditions to know that there's philosophy in them. Mm-hmm. But you're right, I don't focus on them in my own writings, but I do give a bibliography if people want to learn more about them. And I've gotten help from experts in these fields to construct bibliographies. So if you want to start learning about these things, come to my website and just, you know, check out some of the books I have there.
So I will post a link to your website right from the Library Cafe website to make it easy for people to get over there. You have another intriguing chapter in the book entitled Trump's Philosophers. Trump gets into everything, I guess, where you start out with three epigraphs about wall building. And I'll quote them, actually, because they're really quite interesting. One is by Donald J. Trump. "I will build a great, great wall on our southern border." And then that's followed by Mao Zedong. "If we do not make it to the Great Wall, we are not real Chinese." And then after that, Richard Nixon, "I think that you would have to conclude that this is a great wall." Nixon having a sense of humor, at least here. So being the butt of humor himself most of the time, although Donald Trump is the butt of humor much of the time, too, and it doesn't seem to make him funny. Can you talk about that chapter? Because, you know, something comes to my mind immediately. Robert Frost and his line, "Something there is that doesn't love a wall." And then you end the chapter, actually, with a passage from Joshua on the walls of Jericho. So can you talk about that chapter?
Sure, sure. And so what I'm talking about is some of the ways that philosophical issues and issues of multiculturalism play in contemporary politics. And I say that you get several different approaches. On the one hand, I mean, I'm an American, I love my country, but as Douglas Hofstadter had a classic book many years ago, Anti-Intellectualism in American Life, and even Alexis de Tocqueville, a Frenchman who toured the United States and wrote this classic book, Democracy in America, Tocqueville said it's both the strength and the weakness of the American people that they don't recognize differences in quality among individuals. And so they tend to think that everybody knows just as well as everybody else. And on the one hand, that's kind of a strength because it means that we don't think that just because you're born a duke or some kind of aristocrat that makes you better than other people. On the other hand, the downside is it means that the average person thinks they know as much about, say, COVID as someone who's got an MD and has spent their entire life studying infectious diseases. So one thing we see, and you see this to some extent with Trumpism, is a kind of anti-intellectualism, a feeling that the so-called experts really don't know any better than the people who have no training in this area at all. But then you also do have intellectuals who recognize the importance of philosophy and other intellectual activities, but they want to build a wall between Western philosophy and Western civilization and non-Western philosophy and non-Western civilization. So you get a kind of that kind of wall building where even among intellectuals like William F. Buckley, younger people today, undergraduates, won't recognize that name, but William F. Buckley, you might remember, is a leading figure in conservatism in the really 50s, 60s, even through the 70s and 80s. And he made his name, he went to Yale as an undergraduate, and he published a book, God and Man at Yale. Mm. And it was about how the professors at Yale were undermining students' faith in Christianity and laissez-faire economics. And contemporary inheritors of Buckley's approach like Matt Lewis, who's, I think, a very smart conservative commentator, still think there's something special about Western civilization in the sense that it's somehow better than other civilizations. And for that reason, it needs to be protected from the incursions of other kinds of intellectual traditions or other kinds of philosophy. And so what I argue in this chapter is that you really can't intellectually defend the notion that the Western intellectual tradition is this hermetically sealed tradition that has always had a unitary identity and that will fall apart if it's ever exposed to other ideas, in part because, as I've said before, the Western canon has evolved over time. One of my favorite anecdotes about the history of Western philosophy is that Thomas Aquinas had to fight to get Aristotle added to the curriculum of philosophy departments in Europe, because Aristotle was considered a pagan and not part of quote-unquote our tradition. And St. Thomas Aquinas, the great Christian thinker, said, you know, we Christians can learn a lot from reading Aristotle. We can learn a lot from reading Jewish thinkers like Maimonides. We can learn a lot from reading Islamic thinkers like Averroes and Avicenna. And we can learn a lot from reading pagans like Aristotle. And so the Western philosophical canon has never been static. And so adding and exposing it to East Asian or South Asian philosophy is just part of the ongoing process of enriching the canon that's been going on for centuries. Mm-hmm. And I say, it's a return to an earlier period in the recent West when people, in first encountering Indian and Chinese philosophy, among others, immediately recognize these works as philosophical.
So you have a chapter that follows the Trump chapter entitled Welders and Philosophers, and it again is about American anti-intellectualism and political discourse, and you have a couple of epigraphs here also. The epigraph is interesting as an idiom, isn't it? All your chapters have them, and I don't know if it's the influence of Confucius or just the influence of philosophy by aphorism, which is a very powerful way to proceed with philosophy, I've always thought. But I'll read them here also. You have Mark Rubio, and the quote is, "We need more welders and less philosophers." Not grammatical, but Mark Rubio. And then Hans Jost, an SS officer, "When I hear the word culture, I cock my pistol." I've heard that expressed differently. "When I hear the word culture, I go for my gun." Often attributed to Joseph Goebbels, but I think Hans Jost was the source. In this chapter, you talk about the role of philosophy in a democracy and what should be its place in a democratic society from a Jeffersonian perspective. And you make, I thought it was a brilliant statement, that anti-intellectualism is actually the worst kind of elitism, something to think about, and something of an aphorism worth putting as an epigraph itself on a chapter. So can you talk about welders and philosophers?
Yeah, I mean, as you point out, one of the issues I'm talking about is the anti-intellectual trend in a lot of contemporary politics. And as I point out in that chapter, Rubio's denigration of philosophy isn't the last appearance of philosophy in the Republicans' candidate debate that occurred in. There were two more derogatory references to philosophy. And I point out it's ironic for a bunch of reasons. One thing is that philosophy majors actually make more money on average than political science majors like Rubio did. Anti-intellectualism is dangerous for a bunch of reasons. Look, it makes a difference what the truth is. And if you want to find out the truth, that's going to require an education. It's going to require hard work. So one of the most famous allegories in Western philosophy is Plato's allegory of the cave, where he says most people in society are like prisoners in a cave chained to the wall, and all they can see is the shadows that dance on the wall of the cave, and they take those shadows to be reality. But then occasionally someone will break free of their chains, and they go to the surface, they leave the cave, and they see what is real. And then when they come back and they try to tell people what's real, nobody wants to believe them because they're convinced this person must be crazy because they're talking about things different from the shadows that you see on the wall of the cave. And like I say, Martin Luther King Jr. said that Plato's Republic, where this allegory of the cave occurs, was his favorite book next to the Bible, in part, I think, because King lived in a society where people took segregation and the alleged inferiority of African Americans to be common sense. And King knew that segregation was wrong and that the myths that people had about race were just that, that they were myths. And he said people need to be freed from the shackles of these illusory views so they can see reality as it is. And it's a good metaphor for all of us. There are many things we accept that are just illusions, and we need to think hard to overcome those. So I think anti-intellectualism is a serious problem in America right now. And one of the things that you gain from a liberal arts education in general, but philosophy in particular, is you get used to the idea that people are going to disagree with you. People are going to have views that aren't the same as yours. And you learn to deal with those disagreements by trying to understand sympathetically what the other person is saying and trying to come up with reasoned arguments for why either you're wrong and you should change your position, or they're wrong and they should change their position. And so you learn to deal with disagreement, and you learn to deal with disagreement by argumentation rather than by force. And you learn to recognize the difference between a sophistry or an ad hominem personal attack and an actually good argument. And these are things that any democracy needs in order to survive.
Toward the end of the book, you make a distinction between what you call the hermeneutics of faith and the hermeneutics of suspicion, which I thought was an interesting distinction and an interesting passage in your book. And I wonder if we could just hit on that for a bit.
It's not originally my distinction. Mm-hmm. It goes back to the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur. Mm. And it's really just a terminology for describing two broad styles in terms of what do you bring to a text when you understand it. Hermeneutics, as you know, just a fancy term for the theory of how do you understand a text. And Ricoeur said there's two broad styles in how you approach a text. One way to approach a text is to ask what needs connected to power or wealth or social prestige or maintaining your own sense of identity motivates someone to write this work. So, for example, if you write a work about property rights, if you're using a hermeneutic of suspicion, you're going to say, how does writing this book help benefit the economic interests of the class to which this person belongs? Or if a person writes about the nature of gender, if you're using a hermeneutic of suspicion, you're going to say, okay, how does what they have to say about gender enforce the social hierarchies that would benefit them in society? So for a hermeneutic of suspicion, you're looking for reasons for composing a text that are not connected to truth and falsity or justification. They're just connected to ulterior motives for composing a text. And when you read a text in this way, with a hermeneutic of suspicion, you're not accusing the author of lying. You're just saying, how does this work support either this person's power or their social status or their psychological needs or their class interests in society? And people who primarily use a hermeneutic of suspicion include thinkers like Marx, Freud, Michel Foucault, and Nietzsche. And a hermeneutic of suspicion is often the default approach that many people in the social sciences and humanities use today. But there's an alternative way of reading text with a hermeneutic of faith that's sometimes also called a hermeneutic of restoration. And it's a little bit of a misnomer, hermeneutic of faith. It doesn't mean just accepting on faith what the person says. It means you have faith that there's a message in this text that could be true and could be justified, and you're going to make a good faith effort to understand that message and to understand what reasons this person is giving you for believing in this. And so you're going to see whether or not what they have to say is justified. And a great example I use to illustrate this sometimes is the story of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who is the author of the Sherlock Holmes story, and Harry Houdini, who is a very famous magician, but also famous as a debunker of claims to spiritualism or claims to be able to contact the spirits. And it turns out this is a true story. Arthur Conan Doyle wrote Sherlock Holmes, this paradigm of rationality in fictional literature. But Arthur Conan Doyle also was very credulous in accepting claims of mediums or spiritualists to communicate with the dead. And Harry Houdini, as a magician but also a debunker, explained to Arthur Conan Doyle how people were getting the effects they were getting in these seances. He showed them, this is how you would do that using tricks, or this is how a cold reading works, which is a technique for claiming to read people's minds that like any stage magician knows. Now, in criticizing Arthur Conan Doyle's beliefs, Harry Houdini was actually using a hermeneutic of faith, because he was taking what Arthur Conan Doyle was saying seriously as a candidate for truth, evaluating it as a candidate for truth, and concluding it was wrong, but he was considering it seriously as a candidate for truth and arguing against it as a candidate for something that could be true. But there's another way you could read the story, which is Sir Arthur Conan Doyle lost several very close relatives, I believe including a son and certainly a brother, during World War I. So Sir Arthur Conan Doyle really wanted to believe that spiritualists could communicate with the spirits of the dead and could report that the people who had died were happy and they still existed in this other realm. So if we say the reason why Arthur Conan Doyle believed in spiritualists or mediums and seances and things like that is that he was grieving over the loss of so many relatives in World War I, and he just wanted to believe, that's a hermeneutic of suspicion. Whereas if we say, okay, what's his evidence that seances work or that mediums can contact spirits of the dead, and we evaluate that evidence, we're using a hermeneutic of faith or a hermeneutic of restoration. And part of the reason it's useful to make this distinction is that I find people generally are instinctively drawn to one way of reading a text or another. Some people, when they read a text, they just want to know, okay, what's really going on? What's your agenda here? You know, how does this benefit you or your social class? Or how does it support institutions that help you? Or how does it undermine institutions that you're opposed to? But it's still useful to ask, especially about literary and philosophical works, what's the message this thing has for me in my life? What truth about the world is this work trying to tell me about? And so I try to teach my students to ask both kinds of questions. I say, if you never use a hermeneutic of suspicion, you're naive, because you have to understand the political agenda behind various works. On the other hand, if you never ask whether a work is really true and you never think about the evidence for it being true or not, you're not thinking like a serious adult, because you should be asking questions about what the truth is, and you should be open to the possibility that some people might understand truth that you don't know yet.
Interesting. I always tell my students when they're reading a text that the relationship with the text should be like a romantic relationship, where you don't want to be taken for granted yourself by the text, but on the other hand, the text doesn't want to be taken for granted by you. That's why the text is often difficult. It's playing hard to get. And vice versa, it's why you might not want to read. But the important thing is fidelity, that you give it a chance, I guess. So I don't know if that's a hermeneutics of faith quite, but...
It sounds like it's kind of a Platonic approach to learning, where love, I mean, Plato would say really it's an erotic love, can be directed at the beauty in the work, and you have to have that love for the work that allows you to take it seriously. And, you know, so part of doing that is... So for example, I sometimes jokingly say to my students, philosophers often write about the meaning of life, and I'm sure purely coincidentally, a lot of them say the best life is the life of a philosopher. You know, that's a little bit of a joke. That's kind of a hermeneutic of suspicion. It's like, well, no, can't philosophers think the best life is the life of a philosopher, and they argue for that. The implication being, well, the reason philosophers argue that the philosophical life is best is that it's the life they like the most, and they want other people to respect and support that life, so they give these complicated arguments for why philosophy is so valuable. That's a hermeneutic of suspicion. You should ask that question. It's fine to say, Van Norden, you teach at a liberal arts college. Do you have some motive for arguing that liberal arts colleges provide a really unique and valuable education, some mm-hmm. financial motive dealing with your own well-being or your social status. I surely do. And you're naive if you ignore that.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I can actually give you reasons why a liberal arts college gives you a particularly valuable sort of education, why we're missing out on a lot if we only study STEM fields. I think we should certainly study STEM fields, mm-hmm. but we're missing out if we don't study those things. I can give you reasons why you should study those things in the humanities and philosophy. And it would also be a mistake if you didn't use a hermeneutic of faith and say, okay, what are Van Orden's reasons? Are they compelling? I don't have to agree with them, but I should at least think about them as serious candidates for truth and not just dismiss them on the basis of a hermeneutic of suspicion.
So last question, what you ask at the end of the book, you ask the question, what is philosophy anyway? If Confucius and Mengzi can be included in the field, do we need a larger definition, you could ask, or does the current understanding of the term that we have already accommodate other authorities and other approaches? I mean, are we widening philosophy here?
I think we're widening the canon of texts, mm-hmm. but I actually don't think we're widening what philosophy is. Mm-hmm. I was just talking about this. I teach a Virginia philosophy course this semester at Vassar, and I talk a little bit in the first lecture about what philosophy is, and I point out that if you get a doctorate in mathematics or physics, you get a PhD, which stands for Philosophiae a Doctor, and so Doctor of Philosophy. And so why is that? Why is it if you study math or physics or biology, you get a doctorate, it's a PhD, a Doctor of Philosophy? It's a Doctor of Philosophy because philosophy used to encompass all these other disciplines that are now distinct from philosophy, like physics and biology. It used to be when you studied philosophy, those were among the things you studied. But for that reason, there's no definition of philosophy that's going to apply to everybody who's ever been called a philosopher that doesn't also apply to some people who, by contemporary standards, would not be philosophers, like a physicist. But I think we can give a definition that picks out what we identify as philosophy today. And I think what we identify as philosophy today is questions that are important to us, and we agree they're important, but we don't yet agree about the method for solving them. And when we figure out what the right methodology is for solving a particular kind of problem, that field spins off and becomes a different discipline. So if you ask Newton what he was, he'd say, I'm a natural philosopher. If you told Newton he was not a philosopher, he would have been offended. He would say, I certainly am a philosopher. I'm a chair in natural philosophy. Galileo, likewise, would say, I'm a philosopher. But now we classify Newton and Galileo as physicists or astronomers. And that's because we figured out the right methodology for doing physics or doing astronomy or doing biology. And so these have become separate intellectual disciplines. But the problems that are left over, that we don't agree about the methodology for how to solve them, but we agree they're important and interesting problems, those things are philosophy. And what are some of those important, interesting questions that we agree are important, but we don't agree about the right way to solve them? They're things like, what is good and what is bad? Do the ends justify the means? Is there a God? Even the question, is there anything in the universe other than the things that are studied by physics? So does natural science tell us everything there is to know about the universe? Ironically, to answer that question, you can't answer that question using natural science. The question of whether there's anything to study other than what is studied by natural science is not a natural scientific question, because you have to step outside natural science to ask whether there is anything outside of natural science. Natural science can only tell you about what it studies. It can't tell you whether there is anything other than what it studies. And then if we look in other cultures, are people addressing these questions? Yes, they are. Yeah. Are they giving arguments to address these questions? Yes, they are. Are they making distinctions between different answers that you might give to these questions? Yes, they are. Are they writing in all the genres that we write when we do philosophy in the Anglo-European languages? Yes, they are. So there's really no question that there is philosophy thus defined outside the Anglo-European mainstream.
So I want to thank you, Brian, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, Taking Back Philosophy, a Multicultural Manifesto, published by Columbia in 2017.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. This is a great question.